call ourselves the United States of America. Heck, it's right there in the Declaration of Independence, isn't it? And I think most of us tend to think of our unity as a political phenomenon or perhaps a social phenomenon. But did you ever stop to think that it's also a physical phenomenon? I mean, we literally need to get between the states. We need to travel between the states. We need to communicate between the states. We need to knit them together in some physical fashion. And for the last 200 and some odd years, that's exactly what we've been doing. And a British author, actually a naturalized American citizen author, a fellow by the name of Simon Winchester, has written a fascinating book, and we're going to talk all about it today. It's called The Men Who United the States. Stick around.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
You know, I spent a lot of time around law professors, and so I know all about sitting next to people who have very high opinions of themselves and go on at great length about really boring subjects. Yeah, you've been to dinner parties like that too, haven't you? I had exactly the opposite experience recently. I was talking to a fellow by the name of Simon Winchester. He's an author. He's originally from Britain. He's now a naturalized American citizen. He's written all kinds of fascinating books, and his latest book is called The Men Who United the States. It's the tale of several brave men throughout our American history who have built the canals and built the telegraph lines and built the internet connections that knit our states not just politically, not just socially, but physically together. And as I do with most authors, I sat down with Simon and I asked him why he wrote this book and how he came about it. And it took us a while even to get to the book, because the story of how the book came about was just as interesting as the book itself. In fact, just about everything Simon says is fascinating. And in fact, I know it is, because my IT fellow, Brian Presley, was listening to the file. He was checking on the technical aspects of it. Normally, Brian will listen to a file and, you know, let me know if it's good or bad or whatever. But this time he came in and he said, "Sir, it took me so long. I had to listen to the whole thing. That guy is entertaining." Yep, you're right, Brian. Simon Winchester is entertaining, and I know you're going to agree with that. The only problem is that my interview with him went way long, and so after talking to my producer here with Wayne suggested we break the interview up into two segments and broadcast them over two consecutive episodes, and that's fine. So we're going to have about 20-30 minutes of Simon today and about 20-30 minutes of him next week. But that's okay, too, because I'm just back from a trip out to Montpelier where I spoke to a lot of fascinating people. And this week, for this episode, we're going to speak to Matt Reeves, who is the head archaeologist at Montpelier, and he's going to tell us about the fascinating stuff that he's in the midst of doing. So we got all kinds of interesting things. The quiz guy's going to make an appearance. Stick around. Right now, let's talk to Simon Winchester.
My name is Simon Winchester, and I'm a writer. I used to be a journalist and foreign correspondent, largely for The Guardian, British newspaper. And I stopped doing that in 1997 when I left Hong Kong after Hong Kong returned to Chinese rule, and came to New York and established myself, or attempted to establish myself, as a full-time writer of almost always non-fiction books. And I live on a small farm in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, where I'm speaking to you from now. And I have bees and apples and chickens here, which I suppose if the writing career goes massively downhill, I can rely on to allow me to survive for a few years. But basically, I'm a writer who lives in the country. And I'm also a newly minted American. I used to be British. I still am British. But I took American citizenship about 2 years ago.
Well, welcome to America.
Thank you so much.
Welcome to the club. And the only problem with the biography that you've just given me is that it inspires in me intense envy, and I just wish that I were you.
Please don't. I tell you, winter's day, going out to feed those wretched chickens, it's not something I would want anybody to envy. I mean, I like it. It's a pretty isolated life. My wife, who's much more metropolitan than I am, sometimes complains, why did we come into the middle of the country? But on a crisp autumn day like we've had in the last few weeks. It's a sheer paradise up here, a little island of heaven.
Indeed, it sounds like it. And but from time to time, you leave your little island and you trot about the globe, or at least around the United States, and then you share with the rest of us your experiences. And that actually brings us to the subject of this interview, and that is this wonderful new book that you've written, The Men Who United the States. Could you tell us a little bit about the concept behind this book?
Yes. Basically, I had been in love with, fascinated by, enraptured by America ever since I first came here in the 1960s as a hitchhiker. I hitchhiked around the country in 1963, and one of the things that struck me at the time and which has remained with me ever since is that because the entire 8 months that I took when I entered America in the town of Blaine in Washington State, just south of Vancouver, and exited in near Houlton in Maine 8 months later, having done, I think, nearly 40,000 miles of hitchhiking, I entered with 200 crisp American dollar bills in my hand and my wallet, and when I left, I had 182 of them left, so I'd only spent $18. It beggars belief, really, but I didn't spend any money because Americans were so astonishingly generous. Now, that may not be entirely the case today, but certainly to me, I was 17 years old, English schoolboy, to be the recipient of this astonishing largesse and decency on part of these people, I thought there's something remarkable going on. And so,
I think you have to give your younger self a bit of credit. I'm willing to guess that you were a rather dashing 17-year-old and that the British accent probably helped you to charm people.
it didn't hurt. And at the time, I don't know, Professor Harris, how old you are, but at the time it was
My name is Stuart, Simon. Only my students call me professor, and then only when I make them.
right. Okay. Well, in that case, Stuart, 1963 was in Britain dominated by two stories, which was the Profumo scandal and the Great Train Robbery.
Oh, yes.
And when Americans saw my rucksack with the British flag on it, they just welcomed me into the car and said, "Tell us about Christine Keeler, or tell us about the Great Train Robbery." So
Well,
that
I'm
was.
familiar with both of those incidents, but just for context, what were those about?
Well, the Profumo scandal involved the then Minister of War. We had such a title in those days. He was called Jack Profumo in the Tory government of the Tory Prime Minister at the time was Harold Macmillan. And to cut a very long story short, because it's a very long and involved and truly wonderful story, there were two good time girls called, well, the principal one was called Christine Keeler, and he met her, encountered her, hooked up with her, to use a contemporary phrase, but so unfortunately did an agent in the Soviet embassy.
Oh
And
boy.
that was, he lied about this in the House of Commons, and for that, and for sleeping with someone who was also sleeping with a Russian spy, he was forced to resign, and eventually it brought down the government, and Macmillan himself left office shortly thereafter. So it had everything. It had sex, lies, no videotape, I dare say, but the collapse of a government. So it's a story which runs and runs and fascinated people at the time, and it still fascinates many today, and fascinates me. So
And then there
all
was the train
American.
robbery as well.
Well, that was quite wonderful. And oddly enough, I think the last member of the robbery team has just died. I think basically it was an extremely audacious raid. There was a southbound train coming from Scotland loaded with banknotes. A crew of villains held it up by quite a simple procedure of putting a red sock over the green signal, turning it to green and forcing the train to stop in the middle of nowhere, whereupon from underneath a culvert, these half dozen villains scampered out and robbed the train. Many millions of pounds were taken, and it took a long time to track them all down. And the most celebrated of all the villains, Ronnie Biggs, he was called, was put in prison but escaped and went off to Rio de Janeiro and had a child and by a Brazilian woman and could not therefore be extradited. And the story runs and runs. I mean, I could bore you with both of these stories. But anyway,
these are wonderful stories.
They are.
And now I understand more fully why my countrymen, why our countrymen were so generous to you, because you offered them entertainment.
I think I was sort of like a better than the radio stations they were accustomed to.
I think you're right. And in fact, years ago, I was hitchhiking across Europe, and I realized when I was hitchhiking that there was a quid pro quo. And that is that most drivers would stop because they wanted company. And you were expected to be somewhat entertaining if you wanted to stay in the car.
And the odd thing is that, I mean, despite all the, I mean, my parents were horrified and shocked that I was doing this, I had only one potential bad incident, someone who wanted a quid pro quo, which went beyond storytelling.
Oh, boy.
That was in Wheeling, West Virginia, and I ran away from him and everything worked out. Apart from that, it was generosity throughout. It was meals, come and stay with my family. I mean, once I couldn't get a lift outside San Francisco until about 5:30 in the morning when a policeman picked me up and said, I'm nearly the end of my shift. Would you like to see the station? And I was taken to the station and met the sergeant, and they took my fingerprints and gave me them as a souvenir. And then he took me back to his family, and I was able to shower and have breakfast with his family. And then he took me a truck stop and ordered a trucker to take me to Los Angeles.
Okay, trucker, you're taking this fellow.
Or else, right. And then I got to meet, I met Johnny Carson when I was there.
Wait a second, you got to tell me how that happened.
Well, one of the people that gave me a lift, I think he might have been the one. He picked me up somewhere in Central California and took me into L.A. He worked for NBC. And back in those days, Johnny Carson, most of the broadcasts were actually, they originated in New York, but occasionally he'd do it from the Burbank studios. And when that happened, the tapes of the show had to be physically taken to the airport and sent to Idlewild Airport, as JFK was called in those days, for broadcast to most of the nation from NBC headquarters in New York. So this man that gave me the lift was, among other things, in charge of physically taking the Johnny Carson tapes to the LA airport. So they let me in on the set, and then I got to meet Johnny Carson, had a cup of coffee with him. But I was also taken to the set of a real movie, which was John Frankenheimer, 7 Days in May.
You're and kidding me. That's one of my favorite movies.
Well, I was in the background. Never appeared on screen. But,
you're sounding like a British version of Forrest Gump.
Well, there was a bit of that.
You're just showing up everywhere. Now, tell me, the 7 Days in May is a wonderful film, and it has a really strong constitutional context.
Indeed.
Because it's about a military takeover of the United States, or at least that potential. And yes, and it was a very, very big movie back in the early 1960s. Now, which scene are you in the background in?
Golly, that's difficult to say. I remember I met the star, I think, who was in it was, and you, if you're a film buff, may correct me, but I think it was Kirk Douglas.
Kirk Douglas was the hero, and his nemesis was, oh, forgive me, it'll come to me in just a moment, but another very big actor of that era.
Well, I remember Kirk Douglas signed my straw hat that I had bought, and everything went fine. I kept it clasped to my bosom, except I was in the back of a flatbed truck going across Arizona about a week later, and it blew out, and I saw Kirk Douglas's signature bouncing away across the desert.
So, oh, dear.
But the memory remains, if not the hat.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author Simon Winchester about his fascinating new book, The Men Who United the States. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll speak some more to Simon Winchester. Stick around. Once again, I say, hello, quiz guy.
Stuart, how are you?
I'm doing extremely well. And we have a very special quiz here today. What we're doing, actually, during the quiz today is we are going to rerun. We're going to have a rerun of a lunchtime conversation that the quiz guy and I had, which was itself a rerun of a dinner time conversation that we had along with Lynn Uzel of Montpelier, which
resident
is probably
scholar.
A resident scholar at Montpelier, yep. Which is probably a rerun of an earlier conversation we have. We have talked this one, not to death, I will say, but we've discussed this because it's a fascinating question that the quiz guy has been posing to anyone who will listen. So what is this quiz question, quiz guy?
Well, I'm going to tell you the worst kept secret in the country, which is Hillary Clinton is considering a run for the highest office.
No way.
That's true. Hillary Clinton is considering a run for president of the United States.
Who'd have thunk it?
Who'd have thought? But you know what? She's going to have a vice presidential candidate.
Yes, she will.
Now, she will no doubt canvass the country and look for the most qualified candidate to be vice president. But she might just look within her own family.
Wait a second. No, no, wait. Chelsea?
No. Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton as a vice presidential nominee.
So this is one of those crazy scenarios. If Hillary Clinton were to run for president and win, and Bill Clinton were to be her vice presidential candidate and win, could Bill Clinton serve as vice president of the United States of America after serving two terms as president?
That is a fascinating question, and I want to see what our contestant has to say about it. So who do we have on the line?
This is Zach Smith.
Zach Smith, where are you from?
I'm from Parisburg, Virginia.
Parisburg, Virginia. Well, Zach, what do you think of this very strange question that the quiz guy has posed?
It is a very interesting question, and it involves a lot of thought because, you know, you would think that after you serve two terms as president, as President Clinton has, that it probably wouldn't be possible for him to serve as vice president. However, may be possible if he'd only served one term as president.
Okay, and so that's because he's not allowed to have a third presidential term? Is that your reasoning?
Well, not really, I guess, a third presidential term, but that he would have served three terms in office. Even though this is a different portion of the office, I would think, you know, going back to our founding fathers, they would probably not want that to happen.
Yeah, well, maybe and maybe not. I don't know. Is there anything in the Constitution about being vice president after having been president? I'm just thinking out loud here. I'm not trying to influence you. I'm just trying to think out loud because this is a strange question. I know that a couple of presidents, or at least one, I think it was John Quincy Adams, went back and served in the House of Representatives after he had been president, which would be very unusual today. But people did unusual things, and this may be just one of those unusual constitutional quirks that would be allowed technically. Okay, well, I've done enough thinking out loud. What's your answer, yes or no?
I'm going to have to go with, I don't think he can serve as vice president because he's already served two terms as president.
All right, let's see what the quiz guy has to say. So, Doug, what is the answer to this conundrum?
Well, the reality is we just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating. But in theory, based on the language of the Constitution, one could argue that, in fact, Bill Clinton could be the vice president under Hillary Clinton.
No way. I mean, most of us, of course, would think it's what, the 22nd Amendment? 22nd Amendment. It was in 1950, I think it was ratified, or 51, right?
So no person shall be elected to the office of president more than twice. But in that scenario, he would not be elected to the office of president. He would be vice president.
All right. Before I even try to wrap my mind around this, let's remind ourselves what we're talking about. Now, Article 2 is silent on this, right?
Well, what Article 2 sets out is that the term of the president is 4 years.
Right.
So that's important to note. Bill Clinton has served 2 4-year terms.
Yes, he has. But let's just remind ourselves. The language says your term is going to be 4 years.
Four years.
It's silent about how many terms you can have.
It is.
Now, traditionally, presidents didn't serve more than two because George Washington simply set that informal precedent up until FDR.
That's right.
And FDR had the audacity or the courage, whichever side of the issue you're on, to run four times
and be elected four times, even though he didn't serve out much of his last term.
He was a popular guy.
He was an extremely popular guy. Well, people saw that, and people had concerns. And it was after he died, Congress proposed the 22nd Amendment. And the 22nd Amendment was ratified, I think, in 1951. That's what you're reading. That's what everyone is thinking of. Okay, doesn't the Constitution prohibit this? But as you just said, what does it actually prohibit?
So this is the 22nd Amendment, Section 1. No person shall be elected to the office of president more than twice. So the scenario is, if Hillary Clinton were president and Bill Clinton were vice president, nothing bars him from running for vice president, and something, God forbid, should happen to the president of the United States, then could Bill Clinton be president again? Because he hadn't actually been elected president. He's just fulfilling the term of a president who had been removed for whatever reason.
And you make a fairly good argument. I mean, my gut tells me, when you first asked this question, my gut said you couldn't elect him vice president because the only job the vice president really has, other than presiding over the Senate, is to be there in case the president dies.
That's right.
And if Bill Clinton were prohibited from serving again, he can't serve that basic function of the vice presidency. So ergo, you know, Bill Clinton really can't be elected vice president. But as you've pointed out, he actually could fulfill his constitutional duty of stepping in case the president died. And so therefore, constitutionally, there's a pretty good argument right out of the text. We call it a textual argument.
Textual argument.
That, Bill, go ahead and run.
Hey, you know, Stuart, let there be no doubt, the courts would be involved in this one.
I think probably somebody would probably try to sue, but that brings up a whole nother issue.
It's probably another show.
Probably another show. I'll simply say it for the record now. Probably they would have difficulty finding someone with standing.
Standing
to sue. And we'll talk about that some other time. But for all you con law nerds out there, let's just say there would be an issue. But if the Democrats wanted to nominate Bill for vice president, he'd probably be able to take office.
It'd be a very interesting test.
Yes.
Well, Zach, that was not just a ridiculously tough question, but I think it's one that doesn't really have an answer. So I think I'm going to give you a T-shirt in this case.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. But that was a fascinating discussion, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. It's very intriguing. I mean, you really have to, it really takes something to wrap your mind around that and digging deep into the Constitution.
Yeah,
for sure.
It's not boring.
No, sir.
All right. Well, thanks, Zach.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Have a great day, sir.
Thanks. Bye.
Now, politically speaking, now we'll move from constitutional law to policy. Do you think that might happen?
I have to be honest with you. First of all, we never know what either party is going to do.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see if Hillary Clinton does run, if she is successful this time. And I think Bill Clinton's a proven force. I think some could say, certainly helped Barack Obama in the most recent election. And so what does Hillary have to lose?
I don't know. The number one job, people will tell you, politicals will tell you, the number one job of any vice president is to get the president elected. And Bill Clinton would certainly satisfy in that regard. But here's another interesting scenario. Why not just have Barack Obama run? I mean, let's assume he's still popular when, you know, at the end of his presidency, she could have him run. Or she could ask Jimmy Carter to run. She could ask you to run.
Well, you know, I doubt that's going to happen.
It could happen. You're a nice guy.
I would just have too many quiz questions for
her. You're too troublesome. All right. Thank you, Doug. I appreciate it.
Hey, Stuart. It's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. I'm speaking with author Simon Winchester about his marvelous new book, The Men Who United America. We haven't actually gotten to the book yet. We're still talking about how Simon came to fall in love with the United States, even to become a naturalized U.S. citizen. And it turns out it all goes back to a hitchhiking trip across the country in 1963.
Well, this was then the genesis, it sounds like, your love affair with this country and with your desire to see it directly yourself. Is that a fair statement?
I think it is. I went up to Oxford University to read geology and went off and became a geologist in Uganda, and then didn't come back to America. I didn't have any money. I was newly married, and the sort of carefree days of pre-studenthood were over. But then I eventually joined the Guardian newspaper, and they sent me to Belfast for 3 years, the beginnings, really, of the Northern Irish Troubles. And I seem to acquit myself reasonably well, because once, and I got one or two awards, which was terribly nice for the reporting there. And then as a reward by the paper, they sent me in late 1972 to Washington to be the number two correspondent to cover the story that was then beginning to unfold, which was Watergate. So I spent lots of hours at the Sam Ervin Committee and got to know Pete Rodino on the House Judiciary Committee and became obsessed with Watergate, although they did let me loose from time to time. And in fact, I was doing an interview the other day with Scott Simon of NPR, and he said, do you know, Simon, when we first met, we were covering the siege of a monastery in Wisconsin by a militant, I think they were Navajo, maybe not, maybe they were Sioux. Anyway, and you, Simon, and I cringe at the thought, were wearing a deerstalker cap and a tweed Inverness cape. I said, oh my God, please do not broadcast this fact, although here am I broadcasting it to you. But apparently I used to dress rather eccentrically when on the road. But apparently the landlady that Scott Simon and I stayed with has never forgotten this weird Englishman that turned up.
I guess she hasn't. So you came back, and the entire Watergate, the constitutional crisis that happened then, that didn't sour you on Our Fair Land, I take it.
Quite the reverse, really, because justice was done in the end. Well, at least the process worked. I mean, history will tell whether the resignation of Nixon was a good thing or not. But I found that all fascinating. And of course, keeping in line with the constitutional sort of heart of this interview, I was also there for the resignation of Spiro Agnew. So that was quite interesting, too. I mean, a vice president who accepts paper bags full of money is clearly not a not an entirely respectable thing.
I think he did that when he was governor of Maryland, but it certainly caught up with him when he was vice president.
Exactly, when he was vice president. So he went, and then Nixon went, and I was there when he went. It was on the White House lawn. That was a fairly historic moment. And then Ford took over, and there was this slightly embarrassing thing that I was supposedly, I mean, I obviously covered the end of Nixon's time in power, and then Ford pardoned him. He resigned on the 9th of August, if I remember rightly, and then he was pardoned by President Ford on the 8th of September. But was I in the Guardian office in Washington? I was not. I was covering the other great national event that was happening on the 8th of November of September 1974, which was the failed attempt by Evel Knievel to jump his motorcycle across the Snake River Canyon in Idaho.
So there's a strong constitutional nexus, because, of course, he always dressed in red, white, and blue.
He most certainly did. Unfortunately, the red, white, and blue plummeted to the bottom of the canyon.
So. I remember that, too.
Also, I remember my news editor, when I rang, it was in those days, for some strange historic quirk, the Guardian Foreign Desk was where the Guardian was founded in Manchester, even though the rest of the operation was in London. And I called the Foreign Desk and I said, oh, hi, it's Simon Winchester. And the foreign editor, a man called Ian Wright, said, I think you're not in Washington covering the pardoning of Richard Nixon. I said, no, I'm not. I'm actually covering Evel Knievel. And he said, yes, we see from the wires that he didn't even have the decency to kill himself. So it's not going to be on the front page. So you're completely wasted your time there.
Oh, my goodness. Well, those are absolutely wonderful experiences. So, in other words, you're a long time globetrotter and a long time, certainly, traveler in the United States. And so I guess it was natural then that you decided to write this book, which is about, as you say, the men who actually physically united the states through their various endeavors. So could you tell us a little bit about the people you wrote about in your book?
Yes, I think perhaps I should try and explain, first of all, the structure of the book. Because
please do, yes.
It's slightly eccentric. It took quite a long time to come up with the idea of writing about this concept of unity. How did such a sort of polyglot mongrel nation as this maintain, apart obviously from the 1860s, maintain a pretty coherent and cohesive sense of unity in the way that, you know, Canada hasn't because of French Canada, in the way that Russia hasn't, in the way that big entities like Europe clearly haven't. I mean, they're not united, even though they would like to be, or some people would like them to be. But the United States is. So to write that, it's fine and dandy as an idea, but then actually to translate it into prose, if I can call it that, on paper, is not as easy as it perhaps sounds. It's a quite bewildering, vast task. So the crucial thing I always say if I ever teach writing is that the idea is king, certainly. The quality of the writing is hugely important, yes, but not as important as the second most important thing, which is the book's structure. You can have the most wonderful idea and you can write like an angel, but if your structure's wrong, the book just won't work. So I had numerous attempts at structure and wrote very long proposals to my editors saying it should be structured such and such a way, another idea. And they all said, no, this isn't going to work. And I could see that they weren't going to work. And then I came up with this idea, finally.
Well, Simon, before I let you go on, I want to say I agree with you heartily. Now, I've not written any books of this sort, but I've written a lot of various legal documents. And I always tell my students whenever I'm teaching them how to write that that is the key. You must think through your thoughts. You must structure your argument before you do anything else. And though, of course, ultimately the grammar and the diction and all the rest of it will be very important, it's all for naught if the structure fails.
Well, we're on, as it were, the same page. So here, and so, I mean, I could write it chronologically. I could write it with the identities of the people in sort of alphabetical order or something like that. I mean, you could come up, but all of those ideas would make the book more like an encyclopedia or a catalogue. So in the end, I thought maybe the way to do it derives from the many years I spent in China, because I lived there for the better part of 12 years. And the Chinese, like many Eastern civilizations of great antiquity, are fascinated by the idea of the basic elements, what those elements are, and the number of them tends to vary from culture to culture. But the Chinese essentially think of the five building blocks, if you like, as being wood, earth, water, fire, and metal. And I thought to myself, possibly these people, these characters who physically, as you say, welded the country into one, could be organized in that way, and if I'm lucky, there can also be a sort of chronological aspect to that, because the people, let me explain, wood, I decided, would involve those people who were the early explorers, most notably Lewis and Clark, and they, when they set off, they had to forage, to plunge through, hack their way through enormous stands of forest. I mean, Eastern America particularly was covered, except where the Native Americans had cleared it with firebreaks, was covered with forest. They went largely in wooden boats. They built wooden stockades for themselves. They lit fires made of wood. Wood seemed hugely important to the Lewis and Clark and other expeditions of that time. So I thought, well, that seems to work. What did they do? When they came back and reported 1804, 1805 to the Jefferson, what they had found, we then knew the extent of the country. We knew how far the coastline was from the Missouri River. We knew where the Rockies were. We knew where the Sierra Nevada were. The next step was to find out what America was made of. Okay, we know its extent. Let's find out what it's made of. Well, those people that found out what it was made of were the early geologists, and I'm sort of a tiny bit familiar with them because I studied geology at university and went off briefly, disastrously, to be a geologist. And I sort of remembered a bit of geology. So those early people, most of them forgotten, a chap called William McClure, for instance, who from a remarkable place called New Harmony, Indiana, which perhaps we can talk about in a moment, did the first sort of geological investigations of this country. And then much more famous people like John Wesley Powell, who, despite only having one arm, went down the Grand Canyon. You've got Hayden, who discovered Yellowstone. You've got a man called Wheeler, who mapped most of the northern plains, and a remarkable, remarkable man called Clarence King. So all of these geologists are involved with earth, the second of these Chinese elements. The third, water, well, That was the use of rivers as early ways to explore the country. You go up the rivers from the coast. Or what about when you can't get up the rivers because there are waterfalls, you build canals. And so this is talking about the Middlesex Canal in New Hampshire, the Erie Canal, vitally important, which essentially gave birth to New York City, the Mississippi River, the canalization of that, the linkage of the Mississippi to the Great Lakes through the big canal in Chicago. All of that is water. Then you come to the next section, which is fire. And that's that once the country's been mapped, once it's we know what it's made of, once we've employed its rivers, but going upstream by river is very, very slow. How do we get across America fast? Well, we employ these newly invented devices powered by steam and fueled by fire to go across it rapidly. Railway trains, and ultimately motor cars and the building of the road network, and then, of course, latterly, aeroplanes and first transcontinental flights. So fire-breathing engines allowed America to connect itself rapidly. And then finally, so that's fire, and finally, metal. Well, that's the metal wire of the telegraph, hugely important, changed everything. Samuel Morse's famous patent on creation of an electric telegraph and the use of the Morse code. And then that led to the telephone, and then to radio and television, and then electricity, the distribution of electricity, and finally, once again, metal buried cables and so forth, the internet. So it all seemed to work quite well, and I bless the Chinese for this antique method of classification.
Well, I'm sorry, but that's it for Simon today. That's the first half of my interview with Simon Winchester, the author of this marvelous new book, The Men Who United America. But fear not, the second half is only a week away. And after this break, in this episode, we've got something else that's just fascinating as well. In this interview with Matt Reeves of Montpelier, who's the chief archaeologist at Montpelier, and he's going to tell us all about some really cool stuff that he's been digging up. So stick around. Okay, well, Matt Reeves, welcome back to your weekly Constitutional.
Thanks, Stuart. It's good to be here.
Tremendous. Now, what is the archaeology department doing here at Montpelier?
What the archaeology department is doing, we, about a month ago, we just finished up our four-year project looking at the enslaved community at Montpelier.
Right. We were just talking, last time we spoke, we were talking about that project.
We're in the middle of it. This season, and last season as well, we excavated the quarters for field slaves. This is a site we don't have any documents for. And with the past 2 years of excavations, we've been able to figure out where the slaves' homes were, found thousands of artifacts from, you know, their household remains, and really been able to, you know, put them back in the landscape, which is really exciting. Mm-hmm. And with that project finishing up, we're moving to a new project, which is back at the mansion. And what we're looking for up at the mansion is the trying to figure out the formal landscape, what was there during the Madison's retirement years. And what we're looking at this fall is figuring out where the fence ran from where we finished the restoration in 2008 up to and past the temple. And then also trying to figure out all the pine allee, or that double line of pine trees that went from the portico all the way down to the temple.
See, I didn't even realize there was a pine allee. So it was, as you say, double line, it's sort of like a... I don't know, what is it, like a frame for people to look up and down? Or
yeah, when you were standing in the portico, mm-hmm. there was essentially, you were looking straight down this double row of pine trees,
right.
or a total of 20 altogether. And what we're finding from the spacing is closer to the mansion, they're spaced 40 feet apart, but then that line converges down to the temple to 30 feet. So it's what's called a forced perspective, where when you're looking down this line of converging trees, it makes the temple look like it's further away. And so
This
kind of, you know, optical illusion, which was fairly common in the time period. They play with this on the landscape.
So this was a definite design then? I mean...
Oh, yeah, very intentional.
Do you know who actually did that? I mean, did they have a landscape designer who came here? And are there records of that?
There are several possibilities. We have the Anna Thornton watercolor that when she and her husband visited in 1802, she does this watercolor painting showing what the house would look like if there was a temple out on the landscape along with trees. And that painting is almost looks like a plan for what happened 10 years later.
Huh.
And then we've also got records that this gentleman, Charles Bizet, was the Madison's gardener, meaning he was laying out and planning the garden landscape at the home. And so that during this period between around 1808 to 1812, when they're making all these changes to the house, you know, for the retirement period that we just restored the house to, they're also doing massive landscape changes on the surrounding grounds. And what we found with looking at the fence line and the plantings is what these planting poles and fence posts are being dug through are these series of fills that are covering over the 18th century landscape. So, you know, what Madison saw when he was standing on the front porch of the house in 1787, taking a break from writing the Virginia Plan, was completely different from what he and Dolly what they saw when they were sitting on the front portico.
Huh.
Where the temple is today, the temple and ice house, there is a massive blacksmith shop. And what we found is when they dug the ice house in probably about 1809, that's a 25-foot hole. Mm-hmm. They take all the fill and use that to cover over and level out where the old blacksmith shop was. So when we're excavating our units out there, we'll come across a post hole. That post hole goes through this series of very distinctive fill layers for about a foot. You know, these red and blue colored clays that are being dug out from where the ice house was, you know, excavated, the spoil pile from that. And then underneath that, the post hole punches through this 18th century surface where there's all this clinker and slag and iron bits from the blacksmith shop.
Oh, okay.
So, and what we've also found is up closer to the house in this same, you know, line of pine trees is about where you run into Dolly's wing, the cellar, one that has a cellar kitchen.
Right.
That, right in front of that wing in the 18th century was a flanking outbuilding that was about 16 feet by 40 feet long that would have been in front of the house, and it would have had a mate on the other side, you know, closer to where the south yard is, to make this kind of symmetrical forecourt in front of the mansion. And so what Madison does in the 18-teens is he arranged is not only to have the father's blacksmith shop taken down and covered over, but he also removes these two flanking buildings, these two flanking dependencies in front of the house, and then puts in this very picturesque landscape all around. So very different landscape. So we're looking for the early 19th century features, but at the same time, what we're bumping into is this 18th century landscape. And so what's significant about it is we call it the constitutional landscape for a couple of reasons. Mm-hmm. One, it would have been what Mr. Madison, again, what he would have seen if he was out on the front porch taking a break from writing the Virginia Plan. But also that layer of slag, bits, iron bits that we're finding out there that's at this buried 18th century surface, that in a lot of ways is what allows him to even be able to write the Constitution and, you know, do the kind of studies he did of ancient forms of government. Because his father's one that created that blacksmith shop and ran it and operated it as a business arrangement. Mr. Madison's father hadn't been such, you know, an entrepreneur, you know, looking at diversifying the plantation, not just growing tobacco and, you know, probably going into debt when the tobacco prices plummet in the 1780s and 1790s, but was diversifying the plantation with, you know, blacksmithing activities where he's selling goods to local other planters and farmers. He's also a merchant where he's selling goods out of a store on the property, and then also jobbing slaves out. The prosperity of the plantation wouldn't be such that James Madison Jr., the future president, would be able to pursue his political career. He probably would have been much more tied to the land and trying to make things eke out a living here at Montpelier.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of plantations failed because they were one trick horses. I mean, it was tobacco,
Tobacco wears out the land. Tobacco prices are subject to going up or going down. And a lot of places just failed. But because of this diversification, Madison didn't have to worry so much about making a living. He could worry about lofty things like constitutions.
Absolutely. And that's where that layer of slag, you know, I just really, that from the blacksmith shop, that's right. It's so distinctive in the profile. But also, it really is something that's distinctive in terms of Madison's life, but also, you know, where we are as a country today. If it wasn't for that blacksmithing, you know, that was a big part of the income coming into the plantation.
That's where the money came from.
Who
in
knows
fact,
what
when
would
I was
been.
Here, I was here for Constitution Day in 2012, and I seem to recall when they were demonstrating some of the blacksmithing techniques, that the woman I spoke with, perhaps it was a gentleman I spoke with, said that that was the primary source of income for many years, was the blacksmithing rather than the agriculture.
Yeah, that's something we're still trying to figure out. We have the plantation books from the late 18th century, and what we need to do is go back and really look at, see what percentage, you know, tobacco sales, his store sales from the merchant activities he had, and the blacksmithing activities, how they pair out. But, you know, I'd say well over 50% of the income probably came from this blacksmith operation.
Wow.
And it's local. So he's not, like you're mentioning, he's not subject to the ups and downs of the economy, you know, the export economy. You're having tobacco that's, you know, lingering in a warehouse in, you know, Bristol or, you know, somewhere in London and not selling.
So. Right. Well, the obvious question, though, is that what did Madison relocate this the blacksmith shop? I mean, it was obviously a moneymaker. He couldn't just tear it down and forgo the income, or was he that well off at that point that he could?
Well, it's a good question. He, you know, there's a mention in the in a later account talking. This is in the mid 19th century, of a blacksmith shop at the mill, which is over down where Madison Mills on Route 15 is today. And in the 1790s, what the future president Madison is doing is he begins to diversify the agricultural output of the plantation, where instead of just growing tobacco chiefly, he's diversifying. He's using crop rotation, using starting animal
husbandry
and plow agriculture. So he's trying to improve the agriculture on the plantation. And it seems from the records we've got from the retirement years that he's hoping the plantation is going to prosper under that. Mm-hmm. But of course, there's all kinds of problems that arise from, pests that come in and destroy crops. After the 18 teens, the amount of the sale of crops to Europe plummets again after the Napoleonic Wars end.
Yeah.
And you just, you know, there are all kinds of problems. Again, it seems like you would have, might have learned the lesson from his father of having a diverse, you know, economy on the plantation. But maybe by that time, who knows, maybe there's enough rural infrastructure in place by the early 19th century with other blacksmiths being, smaller blacksmiths being present where there's not that kind of demand for those kind of products. It's hard to say. I mean, this, again, it's something, with the research we're doing, the archaeology is providing clues that really, in some ways, are going to drive the kind of documentary research we need to do here. And
right.
So it's a multidisciplinary effort we're looking at here with, you know, the archaeology informing what we need to look at with the documentary records, but then at the same time, the documentary records pointing back to what
right.
we've had
so
in
you,
the land.
So you and Meg Kennedy work together quite a bit, I bet.
Absolutely, yeah. Uh-huh. We'll come up with questions, and Meg's great. She'll, her and her researchers will jump on questions, everything from the kind of, you know, what were the Madisons doing with their sheep to the kind of plows that were here in the early 19th century.
Very interesting. You know, it's correct me if I'm wrong again, but of all the founders I've read about, and of all of them that were plantation owners, the only one who seems to have done well was George Washington. And he ended up being very wealthy. And one of the things he did was diversify and start growing different crops, making whiskey, he had his blacksmith shop and all that stuff. He's the only one, I think, who ended up actually having something to leave to his family and not having to have his plantation sold off after he died.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's in that diversification, you know, especially with whiskey production, having a product that is something that's more, you know, a processed product that could be sold. I mean, that's something to be said there for that.
There is something to be said. And, of course, we also have to say Madison did do his best, and he did try hard. Mm-hmm. I think what really kind of tanked his estate was his son-in-law. But that's a whole other story.
That is a whole other story, absolutely. So,
all right, but enough of me talking. Tell me, is there anything else about the archaeology, or is that that's what you're doing right these days?
That's what we're doing now, and wanted to let the listeners know that we have public programs where people can come out for a week.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And, you know, join the archaeological team in making these discoveries.
We've does that happen now in the fall, too, as well?
That happens in the fall. We've got two more for the month of October.
Right.
And then we've got a ceramics workshop we're doing in November, where it's going to be basically a wrap-up of all the excavations we did on the field quarter. We have thousands upon thousands of ceramic sherds that we're going to be mending, and it's an opportunity for people to, you know, on the excavation programs, people come out for a week and join us in the 5-foot by 5-foot units looking for the Madison's past, features, artifacts. And with these ceramics workshops, what we do is those are in the lab, and people can come in and help us do the cross-mending analysis. And with both, we have lectures about the Madison history, lectures on the techniques we're using to help people put what they're doing into a larger picture.
Now, are these for grown-ups or are these for kids?
It's mainly for grown-ups, but we have everything from, you know, 12-year-olds all the way up to 82-year-olds. So the whole spectrum.
And they're really doing something.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not just coming in and being tourists. They're coming in and they are actually contributing to
the
part of the crew.
Yeah,
I mean, you're putting them to work.
Absolutely. And that our philosophy with the hands-on programs is by making them be part of the staff. Work alongside the staff and treating them as part of the research team, that's how you learn the most. Because until you actually start doing some of this research, doing the archaeology, digging, processing, conserving the artifacts, you know, you don't have an understanding of what it means to, you know, to make these kind of discoveries. But by mixing everybody together and not just having it be about lectures but hands-on work, you really get a much better understanding of not only the techniques and what we're finding, but how it contributes to understanding the larger plantation and farm here at Montpelier.
Okay, Matt, well, if someone wants to come out here and get dirty with you, how do they find out about that? How do they sign up?
Easiest way is to email me, dig@montpelier.org. So that's dig@montpelier.org. Or if you want, mreeves@montpelier.org.
Oh, no, I like
either way.
dig@montpelier.org.
It has a good ring to it.
It's a very good and very memorable. So if you want to come out here, if you want to get muddy, email Matt Reeves at dig.montpelier.org. Matt Reeves, thank you so very much.
Good to be on the show again, Stuart. Appreciate it.
Wasn't that a fascinating discussion with Matt Reeves? He does such interesting work, and he's got this really cool office. It looks like an archaeologist's office. You practically expect to see Indiana Jones walk out from around the corner. And Matt's just a really nice guy, and I always enjoy my talks with him. So thanks a lot, Matt. We appreciate it. And hey, before we go, I want something from you. I want you to volunteer to be a constitutional quiz contestant. Yep, you heard me, you. Not the person next to you, you. Because I want you to come on this show and I want you to match wits with the quiz guy. I want you to answer one of his riddles. We have to get our volunteers from somewhere. And the way to do it is simply to send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org. That's ywc@montpelier.org. And we'll take care of the rest. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. My name is Stuart Harris. And our Watauga Fife and Drum Corps guys are the guys who did our theme song. Doesn't that sound great? Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.